Mass was like, it was so different to me because it was the first one of Mike Flanagan's like long form series that I had seen that wasn't based off of anything. Like, it's not like Bly Manor was the Turning of the Screw. Hill House was obviously based off of Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House. But Midnight Mass was not based off of anything. So it was like him just like free-forming it and doing what he wanted to, which I thought he did an amazing job. Like, the way that he does storytelling is like, I don't know. What were your thoughts on it?
It takes a lot for a show or a piece, like any piece of medium that tries to like dive into Christianity. Like, it takes a lot for me to think it's good. So I wavered a little bit on those pieces. I did think the acting was phenomenal. I think the actors that he picks are always super good. I struggled a little bit with like what they were trying to do with this, like, you know, sort of like the Fountain of Youth piece. Cause I feel like that's also a really difficult trope to try to like work with, and then they were trying to do Christianity too. But I think I mentioned this to you before, like, my biggest beef with it is that I just wasn't scared. I rewatched Haunting of Hill House in 2 days. I just slammed through it, and every single part I knew I was going to be scared, and I was still scared. Like, I still felt scared. When Nell is standing at the top of that, like, the staircase, and she's got the locket, but you know it's the noose, like, God, yeah. it just crunches you inside. And I didn't get any of that with Midnight Mass, so it was still good. I'm glad I watched it, but it didn't hit me the same way that Bly Manor or Haunting of Hill House did.
Part of that comes with like the interpretation too, because like one of Mike Flanagan's like commentaries on Midnight Mass when he was doing like interviews about it is that he said that he always wanted to do a vampire story. Like, that was always something that he's wanted to do. And he also basically made it a caveat that like he would not do Bly Manor for Netflix unless they greenlit Midnight Mass too. So it was like,
okay.
I don't want to say it's a vanity project, because like
it's a passion project.
Exactly.
A passion
and
project.
So, and one thing about Mike Flanagan too that I feel like you almost need to touch on with his works is like this sort of paraded idea of nepotism that like he shows with these particular actors and this particular group. But at the same time, there are also other directors that do the same thing. And I think that it's a comfort thing with the people that you're working with to actually perform what you want them to perform, and also who you want to tell the story. And I feel like the diversity amongst his cast is pretty, like, I hate to say that it's an acceptable amount of diversity, but like, you know, when you look at the actual actors and their backgrounds and kind of who they are overall, like, I feel like they're powerful and they're talented actors. So it's a wonder that, like, he wants to continue working with the same people. And
right. Well, and that's how anthologies work, right? So that's okay, because it's comfort for the audience as well. Like, I could watch Kate Siegel, or however you say her name, I could watch her read the phone book. So it's not that they're bad. And I think we are starting, like, as a country to really appreciate the limited series and the anthologies more. And I don't know if it's the pandemic or if it's what, but we just need these, like, safe spaces that we can come to that have a beginning and they have an end and they have familiar faces. Like, I would watch the same limited series multiple times before I would start something that's 12 seasons long, knowing that I have to
invest,
like, travel with it through, invest 12 seasons into it. So I don't know, I don't have any
there's a
issue
part
with that.
Of me that loves those like extra long series that send like that seem to go on forever, but I think the breaking point for a lot of people was Game of Thrones. You saw this series that went on for like 7-8 years and like essentially like wrapped a whole generation up in this form of storytelling, this like long form storytelling. And when the execution at the very end was not up to everyone's expectations, I think it kind of created this environment for everyone to say, I wasted like a decade of my life like loving something that didn't end up like it's like literally just dragging out. And then creating this sort of explosion at the end that is not what anybody wanted or not what anybody wanted to see. And I think that, like, you're right, with anthology series, like, we find a way to insert ourselves into, like, a beginning, a middle, and an end, and still have this connective thread that goes through it. And with Mike Flanagan, like, a very rare thing happens when I watch his stuff. I never, at the end of it, sit there thinking, okay, I need to know what's gonna happen next. Like, I feel at the end of it that it's wrapped up in a nice enough bow that, like, I understand mm-hmm. what is going to happen next to these characters. Like, I understand what is gonna happen for the rest of their existence. And it's very vague and it's very, like, ambiguous, but it also is super peaceful. Like, it's like all of the endings are very, I think, like, peaceful endings, except for Hill House. And, like, mm-hmm. I know, like, we're gonna focus on Bly Manor and we'll do, like, an intro in a second, but, like, have I told you about, like, my theory about the end of Hill House? I might have talked to you about it before. So
I mean, maybe before, but I don't remember. But I think it's actually kind of peaceful.
It is until you realize at the very end, like, the very last shot where they're all, like, gathered around Luke at the, like, in the cake and celebrating his 1 year of sobriety. If you look at the way that scene is set up, it's set up exactly as how all of the other scenes that take place in the Red Room is set up. So the indication is that they're all still in the Red Room. And, like, that, like, I just get chills. Yeah, like, I just get chills, like, even thinking about it. I'm like, fuck no! Shit. Like, it's actually a really terrible ending. But I don't know if Mike Flanagan has actually confirmed that or not,
But would it be so, it's like The Matrix, right? Like, would it be so terrible to spend the rest of your life in the Red Room? Right? Like, so what if it's not reality? Would it be so bad?
Would it be bad if we were all just in an actual simulation? We probably are.
I would be fine living in a pod surrounded by just, like, a gentle saline soak for the rest of my life, just having, like, being poked and prodded and having my shit streamed into a bag. That's fine. Like, that's fine. I'll do it.
All right. So today we are diving into The Haunting of Bly Manor. I, like, rewatching this show, it's a gut punch to the feels, like, every single time, and it does not let up. I remember, I'm pretty sure I've seen it, like, 8 or 9 times now, like, rewatching the whole thing.
That's so too many times. That's too many.
The last time that I actually sat down and, like, rewatched the whole series through was when Arielle came up to visit, and I asked her if she had seen it yet, and she said no, and I'm like, okay, well, you're only here for a limited amount of time, so we're gonna spend 9 hours of that time sitting on the sofa and watching TV. How does that sound? And she thought it was perfect, so we did. So, welcome to the Damsels Podcast. I'm Liz, and I'm here with Jane. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
How's it going?
Well, I will have you know that I am drinking a beer that's called La, and it's based after Kamala, a strong vice presidential stout. It is 9.8% alcohol by volume. That. So, after this, I think I'll just start chugging Germax or something.
It's the same thing, basically, like, it's at this point, I guess.
It really is. But this, it says 5% of all of our profits go to the Minocqua Brewing Company, which I knew that, but it's called the Minocqua Brewing Super Pack. The theme is, or their motto is, dark money for good.
Okay. I like that, too. All right.
Shout out to Minocqua Brewing Company. Minocqua
Brewing Company that is not doxing us completely by stating how close we are to Minocqua. I think people know at this point that we're based out of, like, hashtag not as liberal as you'd want it to be Madison, Wisconsin, so.
Just liberal enough. Just liberal enough to appease the epic employees that move here from, like, Cambridge.
Yeah, and then take their 2 years at Epic and go on a sabbatical to Barcelona. So, speaking of Barcelona, which has nothing to do with anything that we're talking about today, Haunting of Bly Manor is a series that came out on Netflix by Mike Flanagan in, was it 2020 or 2019? Who cares?
It was 2020.
Who gives a shit? Time is a construct that I no longer subscribe to be totally honest.
I hate it.
There are mixed reviews about this show, especially considering the fact that it came after Haunting of Hill House, which is kind of, I guess, like the breakout horror series from Netflix. Like, was there a horror series that really came before Hill House?
I don't think so. Certainly not one with a budget like that. I mean, no, nothing like that. Yeah,
there was Requiem, which I really, really enjoyed, but no one else on the planet has seemed to have seen. But other than that, I don't think there was really any big horror.
There was Dark, but that's not really horror. That's more sci-fi. Just like psychological fuckery.
Yeah, yeah. Dark was such an exceptional show. Bly Manor coming after Hill House, I think, was like, I don't want to say it was a mistake, right? Because I think that without Hill House, Bly Manor would not have gotten as much recognition as it did. But I think that a lot of people went into Bly Manor
100%.
Like expecting the same level of scares and the same level of like pure dreadful horror that Hill House gave out. It wasn't that. It was very much... It's like, so the very beginning of the story, you've got this woman, like this older woman, played by Carla Gugino, whose name I will never, ever, ever pronounce correctly. And she's going to this wedding and she's at the rehearsal dinner and basically sits down because everybody's kind of talking about how the house that they're at, that the wedding is taking place at, is like haunted. And she says that she has a ghost story and she goes along and she becomes like the narrator. She's credited in the script as the narrator. She tells the story of Bly Manor, which is based off of the turning of the screw. Like at the end of the story, the girl who's getting married, who we later find out to be Flora, who was the young girl from the story itself, she says, you set it up wrong at the beginning. It's not a ghost story. It's a love story. That perfectly encompasses like one of the reasons why people may have been more frustrated with Bly Manor than they should have been is because it wasn't a ghost story. Like it is a love story. It's a story about, you know, two people who overcome a lot of uncertainty, who overcome, you know, this idea of love versus possession and really like share a beautiful, like beautiful time with each other. So I think that it's one of those things that like hit people differently. But I personally thought it was great. Like I actually liked Bly Manor almost better than I liked Hill House. In, like, to a certain extent.
Sure, and I mean, I think there's two different reasons to like each of them, right? And I actually did think that Bly Manor was really scary. I had a lot of great scares in there. And I think, too, when you're going into a story like this that's meant to be kind of very psychologically trippy, it's kind of, you have to engage with fear in a different way. And I love being scared. I love scary movies. I love all of it. I love the horror. I love the gore. Just like, I eat it up. But there's something about both in Hill House and in Bly Manor, but it's a lot more subtle in Bly Manor, is this like, you're acknowledging fear at a different level. Like you have to be willing to engage with the show in a way that just requires more of you, of a viewer. And I think that's why some people didn't like it, right? Is that you don't just get to sit back and be like, jump scare, right? Like, scare me or show me something gruesome, show me something that makes me feel uncomfortable. But rather it's like requiring that you examine your own fears, right? Your own anxieties about your life, things that make you feel like you don't belong, things that like actually scare us in everyday life. And that's what I think Mike Flanagan's works really do. But what I love about it is that it mixes in enough with the type of like jump scares. Okay, we're going to release it around Halloween every year, that it can actually bring people in, right? So like gets you in the door. It's like a Black Friday sale. It gets you in the door with the $100 TV, but you end up leaving with a love story. So,
I mean, I'd be fine with that if that was a real Black Friday sale, if they coaxed me in with an actual like $100 TV and I ended up leaving with a beautiful love story that's an interpretation of both like, you know, queer and heteronormative relationships. So I think I would be fine with that. And that's kind of like the springboard that I want to go off of, is because a lot of the people that had issues with Bly Manor took up issues with the queer relationship that's presented in the show. So spoiler alert, obviously, going forward, and also for like everything we've said in the last like 20 minutes, but still. So
Whoopsie daisy.
You tuned into a podcast that's like, you know, an interpretation and examination of female characters in fiction and don't expect spoilers, that's kind of on you. So I started off when I was taking notes about Bly Manor saying, like, at their core, these are stories about women. And I think that that is something that is really key. And for Mike Flanagan, a man, to really not only help write these stories, but also, like, help direct and help produce these stories, he lends a lot of his interpretation to female perspectives. And so Jamie is actually the character that I started off with talking about, which is weird because she's actually not even the main female character. But she is the quote-unquote, like, not-so-butch, like, lesbian gardener at Bly Manor who, you know, falls in love with Danny, who is the main character, the au pair. And in early horror cinema, gay characters were often portrayed as monstrous. They were, like, the sole purpose in horror films was to subvert society before meeting their expected demise as far as heterosexual or homosexual characters were concerned. And there's a lot of the idea of the bury your gaze trope, not just in horror, but also kind of expanding many different genres. And I think that some people that watched Bly Manor from a queer perspective saw it as one of those shows where they were burying the gaze. I don't necessarily think that that's the case, because if you look at the story from the outset and you're looking at it, even if you take gender and sexual orientation and everything out of the series completely and just see these as human characters interacting with other humans, it's a tragic story. It was always going to end the way that it ended, whether it was a straight couple or a gay couple. I think at its core, that's where a lot of the horror comes from, is the tragedy of it. It's scary because of everything that you have to face. One of the quotes that is kind of one of the first ones that we hear in the story is to truly love another person is to accept that the work of loving them is worth the pain of losing them. And that is, like, the core of what this story is about. It's about work, and it's about putting that work in and that effort into relationships. And I think that regardless of whether or not this was a queer couple presented in the show, I think that that was what the story told.
Right, and that's kind of the ubiquitous fear that comes along with falling in love. And again, it's back to that Black Friday kind of, they lure you in with a ghost story, but really we're going to examine your fears of falling in love with the right person and then losing in them, or falling in love with the wrong person, right? Because Danny is engaged and then, sorry, super spoiler alert, but feels responsible for the death of her fiance. And, like, overarching fear that we all have in our lives that we're going to go down the wrong path with love and end up trapped sort of by our own ghosts. It's that same kind of, like, it's taking you for a ride that you didn't expect.
Yes.
And I think Bly Manor does that a lot better than Hill House does, because Hill House continues to really, like, lean into the fear factor. But it's also based on a story where I feel like if it didn't lean into the fear factor, it would just be totally destroyed. Mm-hmm. So anyways, but yes, I definitely hear what you're saying. And I think you're right. It didn't matter. That's what's so beautiful about it, is that it didn't matter if it was a queer couple or not. It could have been a straight couple, queer couple, whatever. It could have been, honestly, two puppies falling in love. But the story that it told was one that we all experience. Mm-hmm. So
I want to see Mike Flanagan reproduce Bly Manor, but just with, instead of casting everybody that he's cast so far, I think just a bunch of puppies stacked on top of each other in trench coats. And I think that it would be so fucking great.
All horror movies should just be puppies in trench coats. So part of me too with Mike Flanagan is, so I read, like, a scathing kind of review of Haunting of Hill House, because it is based on, like, the most famous horror story basically of all time, mm-hmm. at this point. And just sort of this, the critic, it was an article in The Atlantic, the critic didn't come right out and say this, but the vibe that I was getting was, like, who does Mike Flanagan think he is as a man, a white man, to rewrite Shirley mm-hmm. Jackson's story? And then not only rewrite it, but also insert a lot of her text. And, you know, granted, Turn of the Screw wasn't written by a woman, but still, you're taking a lot of liberties when you're doing this with these famous mm-hmm. stories. But at the same time, I don't know, so I keep going back and forth on that. I'm like, okay, this work isn't super original, but then it sort of is. It's like he's always sort of got, like, one foot in and one foot out, where he's like, I'm going to make this standard horror trope. It's even based on a story that you know and love. Oh, but also I inserted a queer couple. You know what I mean? Like, I just...
Often movies focusing on a non-heteronormative couple as, like, a main focus, creating an air about them that there's something, like, special or different. When in reality, queer couples are deserving of the same love and attention as heteronormative couples without the pomp and circumstance of celebrating queer recognition. And I think that that is kind of, like we're not giving Mike Flanagan a pat on the back here for putting a queer couple in a show, especially a show in a genre that has not traditionally treated queer couples or queer people as, you know, like, normal people. Like, they've really treated them as monsters and as the villains, essentially, in a lot of the stories. So I think that when Mike Flanagan made the decision to make, you know, Danny and Jamie a couple, I don't think that he was doing it necessarily because he was like, oh, let me put this in and get a pat on the back for queer representation. I think that he was doing it because in the context of the story itself, it really spoke a lot about where Danny came from and what decisions she made and how she got to the point where she was. And also, even though we don't get this full-on explanation of Jamie's story, it's there and it's emblazoned in her that, like, she is this person. She is a gay woman, and she is interested in Danny, but not in a way that's overtly, like, the stereotypical, like, butch lesbian. And that's one reason why I love the portrayal of Jamie so much, is that she isn't trying to be this sort of, like, overt personification. Like, she's not, what is the word I'm trying to think of? Like, she's not being performatively gay, which, like, not that there's anything wrong right. with being, performatively gay. That's built into a lot of people's, you know, just, like, personalities as being performative about their sexuality in, like, a way that's positive for them. But, like, the character itself, you know, she makes comments sometimes off the side, like, you know, the au pair is she's too pretty, like, or, you know, when she calls her Poppins and stuff. It's very much like the same way that we would see a heteronormative couple flirt in a show. It's not built up to be this super huge big thing. And so when the twist happens, which, like, I guess you couldn't really, I don't even really call it a twist, that they, you know, end up together, I think that a lot of people didn't see that coming because this gay couple was not painted as this gay couple in bold capital italics letters. Like, it was just put in there because that's what the story had yeah. written into it.
Well, and I think that's how you do a modern adaptation mm-hmm. well, is you don't just say, wow, this original story was set in whatever, you know, the 20s, the 50s, whatever it is, and now it's in the 80s and everyone's got shoulder yeah. pads. Like, you actually say, like, okay, this is a modern adaptation, so because of that, we have a queer couple, and we're not gonna, exactly like you said, there's no pomp and circumstance, we just have a queer couple. I also think that Hannah was kind of, I think you said this at the beginning of the episode, where you were like, it's just enough diversity yeah. in his cast, but I think Hannah, too, kind of, like, because it's not just the fact that she's Black, but it's the fact that she's, like, strong and commanding, and there's no question about that. It's not like, who's this bitch, right? It's like, she just is a strong, commanding character who really, like, kind of takes charge of any situation that she's in, and that's something that, as a housekeeper in the original adaptation, that's her role, right, is sort of mm-hmm. as this, like, sort of ambiguous housekeeper. And then there's the chef, but whatever. So, like, in the original version, it would have been maybe more of, like, a meek housekeeper. Mm-hmm. But because this is a modern adaptation, she's just, like, super badass and is my favorite character mm-hmm. in the show. And you don't even question it. Like, that's what's so... It's very similar to the relationship. The queer relationship is this, like, yeah, this is what it is because it's modern day now. So, like, you don't even have to think about it.
I love that she, like, the vibes that she gives off are, like, very much older authoritative figure, but like you don't really perceive, at least I personally didn't perceive the older part of that too. Like that was another part that was really important.
No, she's like 40.
She never
she's maybe like
she
40.
Never came across as like this old like matriarchal type, which I absolutely adored. I personally think that Hannah and I'm forgetting his name, the chef,
I don't know, but I fucking love him.
I felt like their Owen
could, I don't know, I just adore him.
Yeah, I felt like their relationship was probably the more tragic one out of the whole show. Because another part of it too that like I absolutely loved is this, the relationship that they have going back and forth, right? You have Hannah, who is this strong, authoritative housekeeping figure, but the one person that can always, like, almost derail her and, like, get her to smile or get her to laugh is Owen. And you can tell that, like, it's almost one of those, if there had been another life for them, like, we would have loved, like, we would have been able to see what they would have ended up as. Like, if Hannah had not met the end that she had met, you know that after everything at Bly, she would have gone with Owen. Like, she would have gone with him anywhere. She loved him, and he loved her. And the fact that it was never taken to a point of being more than just this beautiful, true love friendship that they had in the show, like, that to me is the kind of relationship that it's like, oh god, like, that's like, I mean, I'm so lucky that I feel that with Gordy, but like, that's what you look for, you know, when you're looking for true love in a relationship, is this person who can connect with you on a level that is very different and very much like one of the most tragic scenes. I totally skipped through it this time because I didn't want to watch it because I know how much it would fucking break me, but is the scene where she's replaying the interview with him over and over, and he tells her, like, you know what this is, like, you know what comes next, and like, it's all in her head because she's, you know, spoiler alert, dead, and she's just replaying all of this. But like, just the fact that that was the person that she experienced this sort of like awakening with was just so like beautiful. Like, I'm almost gonna tear up even thinking about it. And like, at the point
get it out
where she's like talking to the uncle, who is at that point like dying, and so he can see her and she can see him and they can interact with each other, and she turns to him and says, like, when Owen finds me in the well, tell him I love him and tell him I'm sorry, you know, she says, and the rest is just, and then it just cuts off, and like, everyone on the internet, like in Tumblr and everywhere, was just like, she was gonna say, it's just confetti, it's all just confetti, and I'm just like, yeah, it's like a nice callback to Hill House, but also, have you seen my fucking face and all the mascara running down my eyes, because this is just so fucking tragic and it's awful and I hate it. But yeah, it's like, that is the true tragedy of this story. Like, Hannah got robbed, and so did Owen.
She did. But you know how I feel about romances. I hate them. I'm a garbage person with no soul. If I do have a soul, it's just like a black dying star. But I loved, like, that's, if I'm looking for romance in a show, that's what I'm looking for, is I'm looking for tragedy, I'm looking for realness. And what I felt when I watched Hannah and Owen interact, because there's so many parts of their relationship that are very real and awkward, and if we're talking about this show being quote scary, that's terrifying. That's terrifying to be like, oh, I have feelings for my coworker, whatever that means. I guess she was like kind of technically his boss, but like this, I'm developing feelings for someone who might reject me. I'm developing feelings for someone who might leave because he was like going to go to culinary school or whatever. I can't really remember. Every part of their relationship that never came to be is this beautiful tragedy that's not epic, right? It's not like a Titanic, she's on the door and he's in the freezing water type of tragedy, because that's some bullshit that I could do without. But it's just this like lovely, it's like death by a thousand cuts, right? It's this lovely sort of setup. Will she, won't she, will they, won't they? And then it falls apart and it never is. And that's life, right? That's life. Mm-hmm. That's what's so scary about life, is that you might want something and it never happens. And that's terrifying. And then boom, there's a ghost and you're like, fuck.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I love about Mike Flanagan.
That's usually how my Tinder dates would end. It's just like, boom, there's a ghost. Oh, fuck. Yeah, exactly.
God, sometimes I think about myself, like, if I went on Tinder and just how bad I would be at it. Thank God I was, like, already in a steady, committed relationship when Tinder got big. But, like, fuck, I would be bad at it.
I think that Danny in the show, in Bly Manor, is the most accurate representation of a character with anxiety that I've ever seen in my life.
100%.
Yeah, she has to step away and, like, remove herself from situations in a way that is so relatable. Like, the first time that we see her have this, like, existential freak out is when she sees the car drive by and she sees the reflection of the ghost in the, like, in the car.
The big eyes.
Yeah, the big, like, shining glasses, which is the last image of her fiance that she ever saw when he was alive. It's like she has to, like, she takes a sharp breath and stops. And we see how much this has affected her later when we see all of the mirrors are covered up. Like, she's covered up all the mirrors. And then when the kids trap her in the closet, that is, like, one of...
Fuck that.
Yes.
Fuck that.
I know. That is one of the most uncomfortable scenes that I have ever sat through because of how real it was. And, like, bless Victoria Pedretti and her fucking, like, insane acting skills in whatever she's in.
Yeah, she's great.
She's incredible. But, like, seeing her in that scene go from, it's a prank, but I'm still freaked out, to banging on the door to the point of screaming, to covering up the mirror and freaking out and, like, basically throwing it down because she can't take looking at it, to the fact that when she gets out of the closet, she is passed out. Like, she has been so terrified and scared and upset that she's, like, essentially cried herself into exhaustion. And it's, like, how many times have I felt that way and, like just wanted to cry in a closet and, like, or felt trapped and that you can't fucking breathe, even when it's something as stupid as being, like, locked in a closet, right? Like, your body isn't necessarily being threatened. Like, you know that someone will eventually come to get you out of the closet. It's not...
But will they?
I mean, like, that's...
But will they?
That's how the brain works, though, when you have anxiety.
Yeah.
It's, like, it goes from... I'm just trapped in a closet that I could also probably easily get out of if my brain was being rational right now. But my brain is not being rational. My brain is anxious. And it's, like, ramped up to 100. And that's how I've felt when I have panic attacks, right? Like,
yeah.
I've talked a lot recently about how, like, I'm working in an environment again where I am around other people. And I had a coworker come up to me, like, a few days ago and was talking to me about something and was not distancing themselves 6 feet from me. And my brain, the whole time they're talking, I'm not listening to a single word that they're saying. I'm just thinking, nope. Back the actual fuck up from me, please, for the love of God. And, like, every...
Please remove your respiratory secretions from my cubicle. Thank you.
And, like, every time I hear a person cough, like, I know people cough for reasons other than COVID, but my brain is just like, that person has COVID. They're going to give me COVID. I have asthma. I'm a high-risk person, technically, like... I could die. And it just, it's that sense of, like, impending dread. And someone asked me the other day, like, what are you so afraid of? Like, why are you so afraid to be in those public places?
Did you tell them to fuck off, or
no,
what did you?
No, I fully explained, like, it's the control. Right? Like,
yes.
I am okay
100%.
If I was around, like, Kendra, or, like, if somebody came over and we were hanging out. Like, I am okay with that. If I go to Target, you know, like, I'm at Target, I'm around people, I'm, like, standing 6 feet away from the person in line, but, like, I'm okay with that because I can remove myself from that situation immediately if I want to. If somebody comes over and they cough and I get uncomfortable, like, I know it may cost me an awkward friendship on the phone with that friend later, but, like, I can be like, hey, please get the fuck out of my house. Or, like, I can leave my cart full of useless shit at Target that I don't need in the checkout line and just zip it to the door. But when you're at work and you're in a working environment, like, I can't just be like, yeah, I'm gonna go. Like, because that could cost me my job. And it's like, I can't remove myself from the situation. And it's that lack of control that cranks the anxiety in my brain from 0 to 100 and makes every little thing a life or death situation. And I think that that was the fear, you know, in Dani, is that she was now in a situation that she could not control. She didn't know when she was going to get out of this closet. So to her, that meant never. And now she's trapped in there with a mirror that she can see her dead fiance in and is freaking out, and her brain is in overdrive. And it's so hard to do anything rational when your brain is in anxiety mode like that.
So I have like crippling claustrophobia. I can't get in elevators. I can't. So I've tried explaining to my therapist before that my sort of coping mechanism when I'm on an airplane is that I tell myself that if I really needed to, because I can't stand the enclosed space, if I really needed to, I could pull the emergency latch and throw myself out of the airplane. And like that comforts me, because that's it. That's what it's about, is it's about control. It's about bodily autonomy. It's about being able to control your movements, your actions. I think another piece of Bly Manor that is about that control and that anxiety, right? Because when she decided not to go through with this marriage with her fiance, that was her feeling like she was out of control because she didn't love him in the way that she needed to spend the rest of her life with him. The other piece, right? So now she's just gonna go like willy-nilly and go become an au pair, whatever. The other piece about control there is the children. She can't control the children. And as a brand new mom, I feel that kind of like claustrophobia of, I can control my own body to a certain extent. I can control my husband because he is a rational adult human being, mm-hmm. who I can be like, can you stop fucking doing that? It's annoying me. Like, he's like, you know, doing whatever it is that husbands do. Yeah, they're just like they're always moving and tapping and sound all the time. Anyway. So I can be like, can you fucking stop that? Like, my head hurts, or I'm tired, or I'm anxious, or whatever it is, this sensory stimuli, like, it needs to stop. Mm-hmm. You can't do that with children. You cannot do that with children. Right. They don't reason with you that way. And the scenes that Dani has with the children and with Hill House, but we can get into that another time. I don't want to be that person that's like, now that I'm a mother, because that's some bullshit, like, whatever. But it amplifies these feelings of like, yes. The part of the reason that I'm a half hour late to this fucking podcast is because Miles was just like, aah! And I was like, what? Why? I don't, can you just shh? You know? And it's that same feeling of like lack of control and being like, my ideal scenario is for you to not be doing this right now, is for me to not be locked in this closet, but I am. And what the fuck am I going to do about it? Right.
Yeah.
And that fear is scary to me. It's scarier than any ghost. Right. Because at least a ghost, I could die. I could be like, well, I'm dead now.
Oh, well.
But, like, it's like the airplane thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I could fling myself out the airplane, or I'll be trapped here forever because the flight attendant tells me I can't get out of my seat because we have turbulence. And that is fucking terrifying to me.
It's like authority really doesn't become something that's understood until you're older in life. Like, you get that your parents have authority. Like, you get that your teachers or whoever has authority over you. But what you don't grasp is the fact that, like, you are listening to them because they can think on a level that you can't necessarily process or comprehend yet. Like, that is something that is not within, you know, your scope yet because you're a small child. And I think that, you know, like, what you're saying is very much probably a fear that a lot of parents have, and especially, like, not to scare you, because I'm sure that you've already thought about this a million times, but, like, as your child gets older, like, he's going to do that in ways that are even more terrifying. Like, he's going to not, like, have the same thought process as you or not be in your control in ways that are fucking scarier. Like, he's gonna drive and you can't control him when he's driving. Like,
no, actually he's not. We're gonna become Mennonites. So no, you know, flack on the Mennonites here. God bless them. I think that's what we're gonna do. So
great furniture.
Just so that I cannot worry about that. But no, 100%. And I think too, like, how she engaged engages with the children is so, like, because she's so good with them, right? She's mm-hmm. good with kids. And I hate that, like, you're good with kids. What the fuck does that even mean? Because, like, arguably, I'm not great with kids. Like, I see children and I'm like, hey, you're small and illogical. But, like, you know, like, but that doesn't make.
Jane the birthday clown shows up and is like, hey everybody, you're all small and illogical, let's make some balloons.
Wow, you really have it, like, nothing to add to society yet. Okay, cool. But so she's great with children in that way, but at the same time you can tell that they cause her all this anxiety because yeah. she can't control them. And the closet scene is perfect there. And it just really feeds into sort of, because I've had these anxieties with being a new mom that is like, now that I have this child that I care more about than I care about my own self, right? But I will always have him. I will, this is a part of my life, right? I could divorce Todd. I'm not going to yet. I could divorce.
You heard Listen it up, first Todd. On the Damsel's Podcast.
You heard it. You heard it here first. The end is Countdown nigh. Countdown is begun. No. The end is nigh. No. But, like, he will always be my son. Like, no matter what happens. And I feel like that's part of the fear. Sorry, I'm getting back to Hill House a little bit. But that's fucking terrifying. Yeah. Like, here's this thing. Even if he died, like, he would still be my son. And that's just... Or my gender non-binary existing human. Whatever he chooses to be. But, like... That's terrifying. And that's yeah. what I love about Mike Flanagan is that he really taps into those fears that you have in your own life.
Yeah. And another part too, so like another character that we kind of see this develop in Bly Manor is Rebecca. So Rebecca is this very ambitious woman who is, you know, she wants to be a what she says, like, she wants to be a barrister. She doesn't just want to be a lawyer, but she wants to have, like, her own law firm. And she wants this power and this authority. She's top of her class. She has all of these recommendations. Yet she signs on and wants to become this au pair, right? And she's doing it not because of her love of children and, like, interacting with them, but because she knows who Mr. Wingrave is, and she knows what kind of authority he has, and she knows that if she just works hard enough to get close to the families of these powerful lawyers and these powerful individuals, that she can convince, like, the wife and kids that she is this figure that is powerful and this figure that can exert this authority. And she goes about it in a way, it's like she's not applying to be an intern at his law firm. She's applying to become a right. part of his life that is incredibly important. She is going to be taking care of children. Right. And like, when it comes down to it, I think that's such a crazy good power play on the part of like a female character to instead of be that type who is going to be like, I'm going to gung ho and be ambitious and like, you know, get the very first job as an intern as I can and like wait while no one takes me seriously in this, blah, blah, blah. Like she's building up almost this facade of trust among the family and saying like, you are taking me seriously as this au pair. Guess what else you're going to eventually take me seriously as? A lawyer. Like, right. that's what she does. And I think that's such a skillful and, like, that's a beautiful way of being patient with your own ambition and being patient with your own goals and your own dreams because she knows how powerful and how smart she is, right? She knows that. It doesn't matter really what other people think to her. In society, she knows that that matters and she's going to bide her time and she's going to get that authority in the way that she sees is the most advantageous for her in the long run. And she ends up being, you know, like punished for that because she falls in love. Like she has the audacity to fall in love with somebody. Like she's even referred to in the show as a promising young woman. And I think that that's such a good encapsulation of what she is as a character, is that she is so promising. And when I'm gonna butcher her name, and I'm so sorry, but when Tahira Sharif, the actress that plays her, was interviewed, she said we didn't want it to come across as this shallow romance. We wanted it to come across that, as toxic and unhealthy as it may have been, these two characters genuinely loved each other, and the reasons for that, just to make it as grounded as and real as possible. And then I started to think about the fact that Rebecca is an intelligent, ambitious, and determined woman. She's not stupid. The whole point was that you can be all of these things, but you can still find yourself intertwined with somebody who is controlling and is possessive and still not be able to see that clearly because you're so caught up in it. We tried, not in a very heavy-handed way, to deal with the fact that there is a very fine line sometimes between love and possession. With Jessel and Quint, that was very apparent in them. It happens all the time in real life. And I think that's so true, right? Like, the way that she interacts with the kids, you can tell that she likes the kids. You can tell that she doesn't have a problem with being a maternal figure, that she likes to take care of people. But I think also when you see her relationship play out with Peter Quint, that she also wants to take care of herself and her own needs. And it just happens that she falls in love with somebody who is going to be the end of her, who is going to damage her beyond repair.
Yeah, and I think there's this sense about her that she's really capitalizing on what she needs to get ahead in life. And this idea that she becomes an au pair and that she's like, okay, well, if there were a white man who were here applying for this internship or whatever it was, he would probably get it. But I'm going to take this au pair job instead. And it's going to be a different path, but it's going to get me to where I want to go. I do remember feeling disappointed when she fell in love with Peter, but at the same time, it felt like the right way for the story to go. Also, like, who the fuck could not fall in love with that actor? What is his name? He's fucking gorgeous and amazing.
I cannot remember, but he is absolutely gorgeous. I think, honestly, like, I may be biased, but I think that Rahul Kohli is, like, one of the most gorgeous actors in the world. Like, he's very, very beautiful. He's the one who plays Owen, the chef.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Oh, 100%.
And, like,
yes.
And
he's, like, goofy. Ugh, I love
it. I'm not trying to objectify him at all, but, like, I really just wanted at one point or another, either in Hill House or in Bly Manor or in Midnight Mass, for him to take his shirt off. I wanted it so bad. And it's funny because, and the reason
I feel like he does take his shirt off in Midnight Mass.
I'm sure he does at some point.
I feel like he does.
And I think my brain blocked it out because it was just so incredibly, like, enrapturous. But it's funny because Gordy and I are currently going through and we're rewatching a show that you're going to laugh, but have you ever seen the show iZombie?
No.
So it's a show that started back in, like, 2015 when, like, the height of, like, zombie, like, movies and TV shows and stuff was all taking place. It is one of my favorite shows because it is so fucking campy. I feel like you would actually really enjoy it, but it's so campy and it knows what it is. Like, it's one of those shows that it's like, I'm gonna be 100% on the camp level, but also 100% in the area of recognition that I know what the fuck I'm doing. I'm gonna be witty about it, and I'm gonna just fucking do it. It plays itself as like a procedural cop show, but the gimmick is that the main character is a zombie who has to eat the brains of the victims of the murders so that she can have visions and solve them. Honestly, it's one of the fucking most bizarre
shows. It sounds so bad. It sounds so bad. I'm sorry.
That's the thing. If it was handled any other way, like if it was played straight, right? Like if it was played as a straight show, it would be the epitome of like early teens television. But it's not. Like it's not played straight at all. It is played like it knows exactly. It's actually got, do you remember Alice and Mashaka? Like Ali and AJ from like Disney Channel, like Disney Channel original movies and stuff.
Girl, I'm too old for that.
Okay, well, she's in it. And then Rahul Kohli is actually in it. He plays Ravi, which is like the assistant or the doctor or whatever at the morgue that Olivia works at. He's like the first person to find out that she's a zombie. And he's like a main staple in the show. Like he's in every episode. But it's so funny because like I was watching that and I'm keep trying to figure out like where have I seen this guy before? And immediately when I started watching Midnight Mass, I'm like, oh, okay, I know where I've seen this guy before. That's Owen. It's, you know, the sheriff from Midnight Mass. So it's like, I know this guy. He looks so much older in these shows, like in Midnight Mass and stuff, than he does in iZombie. So if you want to see him when he looks like a baby, like, iZombie is the show. But he's so funny in that show, too. But I think that, you know, it really speaks to his level as an actor for him to go, like, me watching two shows at the same time that are vastly different, like watching iZombie and watching Midnight Mass, to go from me being able to see him as this hilarious, funny, you know, like, character who's like a morgue doctor, to seeing him as the sheriff on Crockett Island and being very straight-faced, and also, you know, as the character in Bly Manor as Owen, and being very, very much like an almost an older version of Ravi from iZombie, which I love. So another part of Bly Manor that is very much tied to this idea of women being treated differently, because we definitely touched on that a bit with Rebecca, but the Bly Manor origin story, which is really how the ghosts sort of anchored themselves to Bly Manor, which is about mm-hmm. Viola and Perdita. And they are these two sisters who lose their father. And this is back in, I think, like the 1600s or the 1700s, somewhere around that time. I want to say 1600s because that's what it was in the grave, like when they died.
They're wearing corsets. Like, we'll just leave it at that. They're wearing corsets and those yes. big poofy dresses.
Yeah. So, and they're also existing in a time where, even though they are the inheritors of their father's estate, after their father's death, they stand to lose everything because they're not married. Like, they're not looked on as equal because they're women. And so Viola, it comments that she's in her wit. She always wears the finest of dresses, always. And then Perdita, which is her sister, is in her sweetness. And she is very much kind of treated as like the little sister, which she is 5 years younger than Viola is. But the story goes that Viola invites a distant cousin to come and visit for the sake of essentially marrying him, because they need to marry, like, one of them needs to marry a man so that they can keep their estate. So Viola marries him, a cousin, of course. Rudy, they pull a full Rudy Giuliani, and they...
Wait, did Rudy Giuliani marry his cousin?
Did you not know this?
No.
Yeah.
Oh my God. What?
Cousin. I think it was like a second cousin, but like this is legitimately the true thing.
Rudy it Giuliani, matters not. Rudy. Giuliani cousin. You have to keep the typing sound in the podcast because we are both Googling it. Cousin.
Regina Perugi. They were married from the 68 to 82.
Oh my God, this is, my day just got 10 times better. Oh my God, this is beautiful.
I can't believe with all the John Oliver that you watch that you did not know this. This is my favorite.
I did not know this. You said that, oh, and I was so like, good. I want this to be true.
You're like, I don't know, that did amazing. Viola like help to relieve the country after 9/11? Like, what does she mean by pulling a Giuliani?
Oh,
like,
what is this? God. Oh my God.
But anyways, so Viola, she knew men for what they were, that they were gluttons, opportunists, and vultures to pillage the wealth of their father through his daughters. So she really wanted to marry somebody that she trusted, or that, you know, she could at least manipulate, because she was...
Like your cousin.
Like her cousin, yeah. So she was even kind of described as being manipulative. And one of my favorite parts is that when they get married, the priest is very adamant on her saying to love, cherish, and obey. But she just says to love and cherish. And she, like, looks to her sister, who, like, gives her this knowing look of, like, you go, sis. You fucking go. You don't say that obey. Fuck obey. Fuck obey. And then they have, not the brand, I guess. If the brand wanted to sponsor us, I would be totally fine with that, because that is, like, those are the shirts that are, like, $3 million or something insane like that. I'd be fine with getting some obey money. She has a daughter, Isabel, and when she has her daughter and her daughter is born, she literally says, like, they're going to come and try to take Bly Manor from you, but you don't let them. Like, and she says, it's you, it's me, it's us, which is, like, I just, like, fucking cry every time I even think about that quote. So she gets sick, and she gets the lung, or whatever the fuck they called it back then. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
It's basically like old-timey TB or whatever, but they just didn't know it back then. and she gets sick, right? And she's literally told that
she gets consumption.
She gets consumption. Something like that. Like when consumed. You dive something vague that they don't know because they didn't have fucking microorganisms back then. She dies of consumption and sin. And so she essentially, like, she tells the priest, like, the priest is coming to give her her last rites because she's dying. And he's like, you have to.
And she put one tit out. She put one tit out, and she got an extra day on this
she did.
Celestial
she
earth.
She got to stay on God's sofa for one more night. But she literally, like, she, like, plants her feet in the ground and is like, I will not go. Like, I will not go. I will not leave this earth. I will not leave Bly Manor. I'm not fucking going, buddy. So she literally says that when the priest is trying to give her, like, her last rites, and she does not go. She, like, literally lingers in death and in dying for, like, years and years, until the point where Perdita, who is now falling in love with her sister's husband, i.e. her cousin, now her cousin and brother-in-law, she literally, like, betrays her sister by falling in love with him, and then she smothers her sister to death, kind of to be merciful, but also to get what she wants, which is her sister's husband's cousin's whatever. So
I am my own grandpa.
She rerouted the family tree. Like, their family tree is a U at that point, I feel like.
Barf.
Their family tree is a circle. So basically they end up getting married, and she raises Isabel pretty much as her own child. And this big crate of dresses that Viola had, because she loved her dresses and she loves her, you know, her fancy things. She leaves this crate to her husband and she says, you will give our daughter this. You will not give this to anybody else. You will not do anything else with this. You will give this to our daughter. It's going to be her inheritance. And he promises her that. Well, when they start to fall on hard times, because the cousin is actually a fucking idiot, who knew, inbreeding, right? She ends up, like, the sister ends up taking the crate and opening it, not realizing that her sister's spirit essentially has been trapped in this crate. So her sister reaches out and kills her because, you know, you do. And they throw the crate and all the dresses and stuff into the lake at Bly Manor, which is how the ghost ended up getting trapped in the lake. And it was through her own stubbornness, like Viola's own stubbornness of, like, I will not go, that she stays at Bly Manor and haunts the grounds. And she gets up every night and she walks, like, the same path and goes into the house the same way every night, goes to the room to try to collect her child or find her child, and then walks back. And the only way that people die in the house via the ghost is if they get in her path or if they cross her path. So she is just this force now. And over time, she starts to forget things. So, and you see this sort of decay in her face and in her personality, where she just wakes and walks and then goes back to the lake. It's this very tragic and beautiful kind of interpretation of how a ghost is this idea that persistence and being so caught up in what you want and what you need and what you feel is going to continue you, and getting so caught up with that it traps part of you there until you lose that part completely and nothing remains of you except just this murdering form. So she kills a couple of people, which is how you kind of see the ghosts that pop up in the house. And eventually Danny ends up getting in her way. So she drags Danny until Flora steps in the path and is like, you can take me, it's fine. Rebecca comes and at this point says, Flora, it's okay. Like, she's going to take you in the lake. You're going to drown. But let me take care of this part for you. Let me live through the bad part for you. And so she essentially possesses Flora and, like, is about to is literally about to go through what she's gone through already, because this is also how she died. She died drowning in the lake. And she's about to go through this again and experience this whole thing again just to keep Flora safe and keep Flora protected from it. And then that's where Danny kind of comes in, and she, you know, she uses the same call that it's you, it's me, it's us, to take the place of the lady in the lake. That is, like, still one of the scenes to this day that I'm just like, God damn it. Like, I can't. Like, it hits the same way every single time when I'm watching it. It's just like a sob fest.
And there's something about that, too, that's just so gendered, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's, you could not plug a man into that mm-hmm. role. There's something about that that is, I remember watching it for the first time, and you know, it's been a year now, but there's something about just her walk, right? That is just like, I will keep doing this until the fucking end of time. And like, it's, you know, sort of on its face, it looks like stubbornness or insanity even, mm-hmm. but it's sort of what the ubiquitous woman, like, across the world has to do to get where she needs to go is just keep, what is that old colloquialism that's like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting a different mm-hmm. result. And that's sort of like, that's sort of what it's calling out is this idea that the woman needs to just keep going, keep slamming her head against the wall because it's what she needs to do. She needs to get to her child and something is stopping her. In this case, it's death because she's dead. Because she dead. Do be dead. She do be dead. She be dead. But I just, I feel that in my heart about so many things about like career, education, motherhood, like being in a relationship. It's just, you just keep trying until somebody recognizes you and then you're like, fuck, thank you. And then you can get it done. What really shocks me about all of this is that it's written by a man, mm-hmm. but at the same time, he's married to Kate Siegel, right? So I feel like she was like, psh, you should put this shit in.
There's a lot of female writers on this show. Let's just say that much. And honestly, what I love that's a little bit more, kind of a little bit annoying is that, so the producers that are listed on this show, both of the producers are actually women. So you have Leia Fong and Kathy Gilroy, who were the producers of this show. And then there are more female writers on this show, I'm like kind of realizing, than I think there were on Ratched, which is supposedly the best lesbian horror show ever, like, apparently, but it's not. Listen to our episode on Ratched.
Is it good? Is it good? Like, I've almost started it, like, 4 different times, and every time I'm like, ugh, it doesn't look that good.
Here's the thing. I don't like Ryan Murphy. I think that Ryan Murphy is...
No, I think
total
he sucks.
Trash. And so, therefore, I attach that idea to everything that he does. And I think that Ratched could have been good if it wasn't by Ryan Murphy. Like, if it wasn't made by Ryan Murphy, yeah. It could have been really good. Sarah Paulson's acting in it is pretty good. Even, what's her name? She ran for, I think, mayor of New York.
Sex and the City. She's phenomenal
in it. Like, holy shit, she's so good in it.
Yeah, she's a great actress.
And then there's another actress in it who's incredible, another actress of color. And then, like, the acting in it is good, but it needed,
I feel the same way about Ryan Murphy. I think the sense that I get from it, I really struggle with these shows where they take a story that is so, like, paramount to just, like, cinema, take, like, a side character, and then are like, we're gonna make this whole show about it. Like, it feels very, like, very entitled, right? Like, Ryan Murphy was like, sure, I can take Nurse Ratched and make a whole story out of it. It's like, that movie changed cinema, and you think that you're gonna be able to make an entire series out of a character, and you're, like, 12. Like, basically, I see him as, like, a 12-year-old trying to take this, like, iconic story and turn it into something. Like, I don't know. Yeah, that's how I feel about Ryan Murphy.
If I'm looking at parallels, right, between like him and Mike Flanagan, like I see Mike Flanagan as somebody who goes in with the same intent as Ryan Murphy but has so much better execution because he's actually listening.
Nails it. Yeah
like he's actually, like, at least from what he appears like, he's actually appearing to listen to the female voices that he create, like, that he's so and he's also not pompous in his advocation, like in his advocacy as well, I don't think, like, whereas Ryan Murphy is like, I advocate for women and people of, you know, different genders, etc., and is like so out there and like outspoken about it, whereas Mike Flanagan is just like, I'm gonna create some of the best feminist stories in, like, in horror history, and I'm just gonna fucking say that they're not even feminist stories. Like, that was one of my challenges behind thinking about these shows from a feminist perspective, is that the women in the shows are so real that it was hard for me to think, oh yeah, these fall into certain horror feminist tropes. Like, it was so hard for me to think of how we were going to talk about these shows, because I thought that they were such a good, like, such a good job was done with the characters. And that was, like, challenging to me, because normally I just like to sit here and pick shit apart, like I did with Ratched for three hours, same. Just ranting about Ryan Murphy. Same. But, like, you know, these are ones that are hard to pick apart because the characters are written so honestly. And then there's so much power that's also given to the actors in these shows as well. Whereas that's one reason why I like your saying that these are a passion project, not a vanity project, because while Mike Flanagan does cast the same actors and actresses in his shows, it's not like what Ryan Murphy does with Sarah Paulson, where when you watch Sarah Paulson in things that Ryan Murphy does, you're like, oh yeah, that's Sarah Paulson. Like, when I watch Kate Siegel in things that Mike Flanagan does, I'm like, okay, this is an individual character each time. And it sometimes takes a minute for me to even recognize, like, oh, that's the same fucking... Like, even, like, with Rahul Kohli, I was like, that's the same guy from Bly Manor, right? Like, that's the same person. Yeah. And it's the same thing with, what I'm gonna forget, is, like, Henry Thomas or whatever, the guy who played the uncle, and he was also the father in Hill House. Like, he...
I love him. I love him His so much. Eyes are, like...
Are those his real eyes in Hill House? I feel like
I don't know. They are. And he is just the ultimate father figure, too. Like, he does such a good job of playing this, like, unsure of himself sort of dad. I will say that, just real quick, can we talk about Hush? Can we talk about Hush and how, when that movie came out in 2016, you thought it was garbage, right? Like, we all thought it was garbage. Like, it's not a great movie. Okay, tell me what you liked about it. Tell me what you liked about it.
I thought it was a very different... So, there are movies that you go in that it's a slasher, horror, thriller movie. Mm-hmm. That you think, this is going to be another slasher horror thriller movie. I know it's going to happen. And this one had, you could almost call it a gimmick, right? Like a gimmick of the main character being deaf and mute. It felt gimmicky in its presentation when I'm watching the, like the trailer for it. But when I saw the movie, like, it felt to me that every decision made in the movie made sense to a point. I guess I just watch it as somebody who really loves the horror genre, but also hates to be scared.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Like, I liked this movie because it was a scary slasher that I could invest in the character. Like, I didn't think that this character was just some dumb horror final girl,
no,
right? Like,
100%.
She's not at all.
100%. What I did appreciate about the movie was the fact that they wrote in her own internal monologue and this conversation that she has with herself about the choices that she can make. And I think that's something that's sort of like shared among all women, that is this, like, okay, here are the choices that I can make to remain safe. These are the things I can say. These are the things I can wear. These are the career choices I can make to continue to be safe in my life. And so they sort of, like, took all of that and smushed it down into one slasher film. And I appreciate that. But at the same time, the complexity of it wasn't there. But I feel like that was, like, Mike Flanagan's way of saying, like, hey, Netflix, I can make money. And I want to give it some credit there, because a lot of people have watched Hush. And now that it's October, when I let Netflix go to my, like, you know, where it just shows you crap you can watch, it's like, hey, you should watch Hush. And I'm like, I've already watched Hush twice. Thank you. So I think there's something to be said there for, like, a creator to say, I can make something that people will watch. Like, give me the opportunity. And I don't know. I was watching it last night, and I was like, oh, why is this so bad when I know he can do so much better? You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not trashing on Hush. I think it's a fine movie. But then you watch Hush, and then you watch Haunting of Hill House or Bly Manor, and you're like, what the fuck, Mike Flanagan? Like, you could have done so much better with Hush. What is going on?
So have you seen the film Oculus?
Maybe. I have seen the Ouija board one.
Ouija Origin of Evil, which was, like, technically the second Ouija movie that was actually way better than the other ones.
Okay, you know what I can't stop thinking about is that YouTube, the same one that does the pregnant one. Where people can't figure out how to spell Ouija on...
Oh, yes. And it's like the Luigi board.
The Luigi board? The Luigi board. Yes.
One of my favorite horror movies, and like I want to say of all time, but it's truly is like one of my favorites. It's got like an IMDb rating of like 6.5 out of 10, but it stars Karen Gillan, who is like... the Irish, I think she's Irish actress, with like the red hair, and she was Amy Pond in Doctor Who.
Yes, I love her. I have seen that movie. That's the one, the mirror. That's the one with the mirror. Yes. I've seen it.
That is a Mike Flanagan movie as well.
It is? Oh, it's so good. I love that movie.
It is. It's so good. And like, that's one thing that I love about it is that like I want to say I don't really like people in cinema, directors especially, who are consistent. I don't really like the consistency. I like to see growth. And I saw, like, going from... So his movie in 2011, Absentia, I remember watching that. I doubt that she remembers us watching it together, but I watched that with my friend Crystal. It was like we were just watching scary movies and stuff like late at night, like not really like doing anything. We watched his movie Absentia. At this point, I don't know who Mike Flanagan is. I could care less. I remember falling asleep during that movie. I thought it was so stupid. And yet going from that to just a couple years later doing Oculus, and then a couple years later doing Hush, and a couple years later doing Before I Wake, and now we've got Haunting of Hill House, we have Bly Manor, we have Doctor Sleep, we have Midnight Mass, The Midnight Club, which is coming out next year, and now he's going to be doing Fall of the House of Usher, which is one of my favorite Edgar Allan Poe stories. Like, I'm just excited to see the growth happen, like, even more. And I'm excited to see what he does with an Edgar Allan Poe story specifically, because those are stories that, like, if you want to talk about feminism being rooted in very weird places, like, Edgar Allan Poe has a lot of both feminist and anti-feminist literature, like, kind of overall.
100%.
And interpretations of his stories are both very much on either side of that scale. So I would be so excited to talk about that one. But, like, I just love that when we see the growth from Mike Flanagan happen, it's been in a way that's, like, almost quiet. Like, you don't really know exactly what you're gonna get from him. It's like Kevin Smith, right? Like, I never appreciated how good of a movie Red State was until I had seen it, like, years and years later. And, like...
Wait, Red State is Kevin Smith?
I think it's Kevin Smith.
Wait, what? No, you're probably right, but...
Yep, it's directed by Kevin Smith.
Shut up.
Isn't that the weirdest thing, though? You would never, ever, ever think that that was directed by Kevin Smith, right? That's what I'm saying about consistency. Consistency in directors is kind of boring, I'm going to say. Like, I love that the same person that did Clerks did fucking Red State. And also did Walrus, too. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen Walrus, but he also did Walrus.
Also did what?
Walrus.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or Tusk. No, it's not called Walrus. It's called Tusk. It's called Tusk.
I knew what you meant.
You know what I'm talking about. When I googled,
was like, yeah, I got you. When I googled Red State, I got Red State, conservative blog and conservative news source. I'm going to go ahead and give a little clicky click. Oh, no.
Click it.
My algorithms.
Yeah. No, I typed in Red State and immediately got Red State movie watch online free. So I think that my algorithm is a little bit more in tune with who I am than yours is.
This is my work computer. It doesn't know yet.
Okay. Gotcha. So Bly Manor, overall, I think it's fucking great. Like, I'm never gonna have a thing to say about it that's anything less than it destroys me, and it's fucking lovely. I love it. It's not perfect, but it's so good. Perfect is boring.
I love Bly Manor. I love Haunting of Hill House. We could have a whole conversation about how Midnight Mass let me down, but I think there's something to be said for having Netflix, which pumps out garbage on a weekly basis, to invest in something that is Halloween-y, right? And it just kind of like has value beyond horror. I don't know. Like, do we even deserve that as humanity anymore? Probably not. But we got it. And thanks, Mike Flanagan.
Yeah, and it's one thing about the horror genre, too, that, like, I read this article maybe when I was, like, I don't know, 12 years old and had no business knowing what the New York Times was. But I just remember, like, reading this article once when I was small that, like, horror movies do so much better when we're in a bad economy and, like, when there's bad things going on in the world because of the idea of escapism. And I think that there's going to be an evolution of that that we're seeing already happen where that's not necessarily the case anymore. Because I think that using horror movies as escapism and thinking, oh, wow, this, like, this person's life is so much worse than mine because they're being hunted by a man in a mask and a chainsaw. Like, I think that that idea is one that will still be there. But I think that the horror genre, especially in the past few years, is really taking a turn towards, let's take these real problems that people have and let's interpret them in a way that we can show how fucking scary they actually are. And I think that Bly Manor does that, especially with the idea of love and the idea of loss, and then Hill House with the idea of grief. Like, Hill House was like the WandaVision of horror to me. Like, it yes, deals with 100%. Grief in a way that's so unbound and so, like, uncommon. And I think that that's one thing that Mike Flanagan does, is he takes these concepts and really kind of builds on them in a way to show how scary real life can be, in a way that kind of psychologically fucks you up a little bit when you're done watching it. But then you realize it was just a show. It's okay. You know, things are okay. So,
and he's not afraid to play with gender either. Like, he's not afraid to say that the father in Haunting of Hill House is trapped in his own masculinity and just keeps saying, I can fix this, I can fix this, I can fix this. Whereas the mother is so in tune to her own motherhood and femininity that she's willing to die for it. He's not he doesn't shy away from that. He's like, yeah, these are the gendered roles and this is what it is, and that's what's so scary about life and family and loss. And I love that, and it's just such an amazing show. There's been exactly one show that I've rewatched in my entire life, and it's been The Haunting of Hill House.
That's
boom. Yeah.
I can't even imagine, because I've seen and the Last Airbender like 40 times.
And The Simpsons, but that doesn't count.
I mean, that one's got watchability for days, especially after me watching it the first time and thinking that it was made 4 days before we recorded our episode on it because it was still so fucking relevant. Mm-hmm. But I think that about wraps it up for Haunting of Bly Manor. Any other thoughts, Jane?
No, I just want to say thank you for listening to me ramble, as always.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thank you guys so much for listening. I do want to say, and this is like total celebration moment, but we have reached officially an average of 100 listens per episode, which sounds super small, but it's kind of a big deal for us.
No, it's not small.
So big shout out.
I don't even know 100 people.
Yeah, right. Keep listening on your platform of choice, whether it's Spotify, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on Podcaster, we're on a bunch of websites whose names I've never heard before in my life, which is crazy. And we also have a Patreon, which I am going to mention a million times over, just because please help me quit my job and buy an island with a bunch of dogs so I can just make podcasts all day. That would be the fucking dream. But for, you know, like $5 a month, you can help this little podcast keep chugging along. It really, really helps. Any little bit helps. And also we have a Facebook, we have an Instagram. Feel free to follow us on both of those. With the Patreon, you'll also get updates sent to your inbox whenever we have new episodes, and you will get those episodes days ahead of time, so a couple days ahead of schedule. So thank you guys so much for listening. We love you. We appreciate you. Keep being amazing.
Bye.